You're watching Bedtime Stories Book Post.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you for joining us here at Red Ice TV. It's good to be back with you once again. Hope you had a great St. Patrick's Day yesterday, but only if you're Irish. Otherwise, you're not allowed. All right. So we're doing, kind of an impromptu. I talked with Grandma Rudolph here a couple of days ago, and we decided to do it today, Tuesday. It is the 18th of March, 2025. Hope you're all doing well out there. Grandma, welcome back. Thank you for joining us again. How are you?
Well, thank you for having me.
You bet.
Much appreciated.
Good to see you again. I know you wanted to talk about this case, and we've covered it kind of on and off a little bit in terms of what's been happening at the university, specifically Columbia University, but there are other investigations happening over multiple. I think it was a list of like 75 universities that they're looking at. And, of course, it's over the issue of these pro-Palestinian protests. The kind of the Trump administration is calling them pro-Hamas. We can get into the distinction and what, but regardless, this is what they're doing. And it was this one famous case. Let me see if I can pronounce his name correctly now as well. His name is Mahmoud Khalil.
Khalil.
There you go. Thank you for clarifying. Thank you for the kh sound. I appreciate that. He is the one that they've kind of started off with, I guess, to a certain extent. This is the guy right here. He's born in Syria, but he was been raised in Palestine, living in Palestine for a long time. And obviously, of course, that environment at Columbia University has kind of fostered this as well, to be honest. There's a lot of people at the Columbia University environment, which is like, well, Israel is kind of a white supremacist state. So this is like an offshoot of a lot of this leftist kind of cultural Marxism type of environment at these universities, at least if you ask me. However, this the issue then of like, okay, what is free speech? Is Hamas then a terrorist organization? How do you prove this? There's a lot of, you know, things in the weeds here that we kind of get into. But what's your initial impression when you heard about this, Grimar?
Well, the initial impression was for me devastating. Happened on Sunday, 9 days ago. And I didn't instantly hear about it. I met a friend the next Tuesday, so exactly a week ago. And he told me about it, and it instantly put me in a state of anxiety, since I'm a green card holder myself. And hearing that guys getting arrested without any criminal charges, without any criminal history, just because he has been organizing demonstrations, which should be covered by the First Amendment, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech. That instantly put me on high alert, thinking I could possibly be next. Now, I have not been involved in any demonstrations or activities when it comes to Palestine. It was not for the lack of trying, though. We had, when it started back in October 23, we had some internal turmoil at Castle Hillback, as the publishing company was called. It then went belly up a short while after because of this internal complications that we had, and Coda and everything else was disappearing. The encyclopedia, everything I was involved in was kind of wiped off the internet. So we had a struggle to keep things going and to resurrect stuff. So I didn't have time to focus on that because there was so much bad stuff going on. But then we had a marketing guy who was supposed to find out at which universities and colleges are these demonstrations most prevalent, most intense, and then find out what kind of publications are there, online blogs, student newspapers and so forth that are involved in it, and then make promotion for our kind of free speech issues. And books, and in particular the Encyclopedia, which had just then appeared in its first edition. And for some reason, our marketing guy was hogging the topic for 3-4 months without doing anything about it. And we were getting very close to firing him because he wasn't. Eventually, we completely pivoted our approach to marketing, and we thought, well, pitching our thoughts to university campuses, which is actually something where our free speech organization, the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, CODOH, CODOH.com, has started in the 1990s, placing advertisement at university campuses, campus newspapers. That's how the organization grew.
Okay.
And that's actually the trigger for Deborah Lipstadt's book, Denying the Holocaust. If you see the first edition of her book, it has a collage of newspaper clippings that shows advertisement that CODOH had placed. And this uproar that was caused in the 1990s due to these ads was the trigger for sponsors to approach Deborah Lipstadt to write a book against, quote-unquote, Holocaust denial. That had a lot of effects down the road. David Irving sued her, leading to a massive trial and showdown in London starting in 1999, going into 2000. With a lot of public attention. This is the origin of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust and the free speech organization which I am involved, and where we wanted to have now, with this student uproar happening at the university over what's going on in Gaza, place ads again. Because over the past several years, we couldn't initially, censorship by the ADL, the New York Times, and other organizations that had ganged up against us, making sure that all university campus newspapers have a blacklist of advertisers who are not allowed to place ads. So we couldn't get any ads anymore in the late 2000s, early 2010s. So we gave up on the project. But we thought, well, no, it's a new generation, a new attitude, let's start. Anyway, our marketing guy wasn't going for it. We shifted then away and went for podcasts that were open to our ideas. There it is. You see all the clippings.
Yeah, right.
Scandals. And
yep.
That's the first edition. So these are reactions to advertisements that CODOH had placed. Yes, the sabotage, he insists he didn't do it on purpose. He was just busy with so many things in his life, family taking center stage for him because he has two little children. He just didn't find the time to do it. On the upside, since we didn't get our finger in that cookie jar, we didn't get slammed with anything either.
Right, yeah.
So in hindsight...
Just don't say anything, you'll be safe.
Yeah, so I didn't get involved. We are the organization, and me particularly as one of the most prominent people there, didn't get involved in it. And we got some flack by people. Why aren't you? It's just internal turmoil combined with logistical and communication problems. Just we missed that boat. And fortunately for me, they can't use this kind of leverage to put me in the proximity of people who justify, support, or whatever, quote-unquote, terrorist organizations, which Hamas is labeled as being in this country, of course.
Yeah.
To that, I always say, well, the one person's terrorist is the other person's freedom fighter. This is the way it's always just been in areas where people are suppressed by any imperialist power. I remember the IRA of yore talking about St. Patrick's Day. Mm-hmm. The Irish remember that.
Yep.
The Irish were brutally suppressed by the English for centuries, particularly Northern Ireland, after the Republic itself became independent after the First World War. And in Northern Ireland, finally, persecution got so bad that the Irish Republican Army turned violent. I would say counter-violent, because they weren't the ones who started the fighting. And eventually, of course, they were seen as a terrorist organization. Their political arm, Sinn Féin, in the Republic of Ireland was a recognized political party, and this to this day, if I'm not mistaken. And they were officially slash unofficially supporting or in contact with the IRA, the militant arm, so to say. So a hodgepodge of things once you turn violent in trying to liberate your people from oppression, from violent oppression in particular.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
The Palestinians have faced even worse than the Northern Irish. Then you tread into a territory where you can be and will be labeled a terrorist by those who you oppose.
Yeah.
That's just the name of the game everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, if you win the struggle, you're seen as the liberator. But if you don't, you're the you're the awful, horrible terroristic enemy that was crushed, and the victor stays on top. But yeah, that's the nature of it, right? So obviously, it's all related. I think it's also all related by the people who are doing this, from ICE, from people inside of Trump's administration. There's these interests that these protests were no good, and this leads, of course, to then, in their words, that's Hamas support. So they're terrorists, kind of adjacent, but baked into that cake, you have things like then, at what point are you allowed to criticize Israel? Especially revisionism, so-called Holocaust denial, and these kinds of things. They're all very adjacent. So one could see that if these types of cases starts going through, that could expand. The goalpost for that could move fairly quickly. What do you think will happen here with this?
I can tell you what I hope that happens. I hope that it doesn't happen. What I think that happens, I've always said, once we are on a trajectory of success, I've seen that in the past over and over again. If there is some success, some positive feedback from the broader society, that Holocaust skepticism gains more and more acceptability, becomes kind of normal in good society, then the spiral of oppression and censorship takes another turn or several turns to deter people with even more violent and brutal suppression. We have seen again with in the context of the protests against what Israel is doing in the occupied territories, as well as due to the material we can now offer with the encyclopedia in particular, that makes that information much more accessible than anything we had before, that we are on a path of Holocaust skepticism becoming acceptable in good society, which is something that the mainstream, of course, certain forces, certain groups in the mainstream want to prevent under any circumstances. What would be the best way for them of achieving that is, of course, increasing oppression against these dissidents and making sure they're going away one way or another, and deporting me would be one. I don't want to give the recipe for them or how they solve their problems, but that's what I fear could happen. Yes, they expand it to quote-unquote Holocaust denial just as much. I don't really believe, unless I've seen recordings or copies of Khalil's writings, that he has been supportive of terrorist activities, that is to say, violent excesses against Jewish civilians.
What are the? I monitored that early on. Maybe this is continued, whatever. But I remember seeing some footage of like them kind of like yelling at like a Jewish student or something like that. But violence? Have you actually seen any violence by the pro-Palestinian protest at these university campuses specifically? I mean, no.
I have not paid too much attention to it, I must say. I couldn't make a statement about it. For me, right now, it's Khalil. He is arrested for supporting terrorism. But what does that mean? The administration has a track record of lying, exaggerating, distorting stuff to get their way. And I don't believe that he did anything like supporting violent acts against innocent civilians. So what is terrorism? If a Hamas fighter fights against Israeli soldiers, that's not terrorism. That's called war. If he were to assault civilians, that is terrorism. That's actually what the Israeli army is doing, has been doing all along. So it's a terrorist army. If you call the Israeli army and their actions a terrorist army, then the state of Israel is a terrorist state. And if you say that, then you can't make the equation. Well, that's what Hamas says, and therefore you have similar opinions, and therefore you are supportive, and therefore you are a terrorist.
Yeah.
This is the kind of rhetoric that takes something that can be perfectly justified and has nothing to do with Hamas or not Hamas to put you in their pool.
Yeah, because he's
I've seen that in cases where revisionists are persecuted too. In my very first case, I wrote an expert report that doesn't even mention the Jew, word Jew a single time, and yet I was sentenced for inciting the masses to hatred against Jews, even though the word doesn't even exist in this expert report. So it
Right.
doesn't really, for them to make the point, it doesn't really require of Khalil having done anything.
No, exactly. And I mean, what's interesting about this too, you could even, I'm not sure if this is the right spot for or not, but I do want to mention it regardless, right? Because if your support for Hamas is considered terrorism, why don't we talk a little bit about the history of Netanyahu supporting and bolstering Hamas? Now, they didn't found them, right? But apparently along the way, they funded them. Let me, again, to make the case, let's play that famous clip. There's, well, Ron Paul mentions it even, but there's ex-Israeli prime ministers, Ehud Barak mentioned this. Let's play these two, and I want your comment on this after. Listen to this, sir.
If you look at the history, you'll find out that Hamas was encouraged and really started by Israel because they wanted Hamas to counteract Yasser Arafat. And you say, well, yeah, that was better then and it served its purpose, but we didn't want Hamas to do this. So then we as Americans say, well, we have such a good system, we're going to impose this on the world. We're going to invade Iraq and teach people how to be Democrats. We want free elections. So we encourage the Palestinians to have a free election. They do, and they elect Hamas. So we first indirectly and directly through Israel help establish Hamas. Then we have election. Then Hamas becomes dominant, so we have to kill them. You know, it just doesn't make sense.
Here's Ehud Barak. Listen to this.
So are you saying Benjamin Netanyahu deliberately boosted Hamas to try to prevent a Palestinian state?
Yeah, sure. He deliberately and systematically even told, on record, whoever wants to avoid the threat of a two-state solution has to support my policy of paying protection money to the Hamas.
So what we did, with the permission of our prime minister, is to let Qatar to transfer a huge amount of money in cash, probably more than $1.4 billion. By doing it, we increased the power of Hamas. We did everything in order to make sure that Hamas will go on controlling Gaza, and Palestinian Authority will control the West Bank, so they will fight each other.
So that's a classic, right? Blowback. They support one group to cause division or whatnot. But I think it's an interesting thing to kind of bring into this whole conversation because they're largely responsible for making sure that it does, in a way, kind of have the power, right, in the Gaza Strip like it does today. And of course, then you can argue, what Netanyahu's role in all of that is.
Yeah,
Yeah.
miscalculations happened many times. I remind you of Osama bin Laden, who during
Yeah.
the Afghani war against the Soviets was built up and basically created as the leader of the Taliban by the United
Yeah,
States for 10
Al-Qaeda, right? The
years.
base, they call it the
Right. The
yeah.
whole thing is it's not a US creation. They were there, but they were nothing compared to the power they are now, and they were fed and grown into what they are by the United States.
Yeah, and their proxy war against the Soviet
Right,
Union. Yep,
right,
yep.
right. So that blew up in their faces, and that happens over and over again if you do these kinds of shifty operations where the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that is the kind of tactic which will blow up in your face because he's not your friend
No. They
as
take
you
advantage
return.
of you as long as they can, and yeah,
Right.
exactly. I mean, again, not that this will look, this is obviously not going to change any of the, if there are legal cases here eventually, because as you say, so far this is kind of very in a gray zone, I guess, of sorts. Like, wait, what's actually all the charges and things like this. But not that this will be taken into account, but I think these are points we should continue to reiterate when we bring these up to help to educate people that, like, this is not as cut and dry as people think. This is just not some terrorist group that showed up and had, like, murderous vengeance for Jews one day for no reason. First, they were propped up, and then, of course, you have decades, as you mentioned, of suppression of the Palestinians and the conditions in the Gaza Strip and all this stuff. Like, what are they supposed to do? Like, what options do you have left, essentially? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a huge open prison, if you wish, as somebody has said. It's the biggest concentration camp. But it doesn't really bring to living conditions normally in Gaza before what happened on October 7th were better than in a prison, better than a German concentration camp or any concentration camp, unless you got on occasion hit by Israeli missile. Oh, these missile strikes forth and back have been going on for decades. The story is long, is convoluted, and goes back a century and more, basically with the start of the Zionist movement in the late 19th century. And it keeps on going. Jews keep expanding and pushing out the non-Jewish populace and confining them to more and more constricted places, trying to make them go away voluntarily, and if not, they use some more force. It's been going on since 1948, since Deir Yassin. So nothing new there.
No, nothing.
Now, coming back to the Khalil case, strictly legally speaking, since he has no criminal charges and they don't claim he's going to be charged with anything, they should not be able to arrest him and deport him. However, ever since we have had the Patriot Acts after 9/11, the government has some leeway when it comes to claims that someone is involved in terrorist activities, supporting terrorist groups, supporting terrorist states, to take away certain rights, due process rights, and what have you. They can't just arrest them, confine them. It's what has happened after 9/11 with a lot of people ending up in Guantanamo Bay without any charges, held for years, even decades, in dismal circumstances. And of course, most of these were not green card holder, but that's what they can do with pretty much anyone. I know of a case of a lady, a lower diplomat, who was involved in American embassy, I think, in Baghdad during the Saddam Hussein time, running up to the war against Iraq in 2003. And she later wrote a book about it. She tried to negotiate between the Iraqis and the Americans after 9/11. The Iraqis were, Hussein was willing to offer all kinds of things to get out of this, the crosshairs of the United States, including allowing other parties having democratic elections and allowing the American corporations to plunder the country's natural resources. So Hussein was desperate, but the Americans were turning a deaf ear to it. They were dead set on invading and crushing the regime. And so the diplomat was then publishing what was going on and talking out about it publicly because she couldn't believe the mendacity of the U.S. diplomatic corps. And she got arrested. She disappeared for a number of years in one of the detention centers that officially don't exist, even in this country. I think Guantanamo Bay is the only one. Guantanamo Bay, everybody knows about, and that exists, and it's clear. But there seems to be, and she says so much, that she's been held in a detention center here in the United States without charges for a number of years. Finally, she was released, and then she published a book about it.
Interesting.
And had podcasts. So that can happen even to U.S. citizens.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the asset forfeiture, they frame you. I mean, all kinds of things. The legal system is never intact in that kind of capacity, right? And it's if someone has it out for you for whatever reason, yeah, you will end up in trouble if that's the case. Now, this, again, a side note, but just to show the international meddling and stuff like this, right? Of like even this is Camp Buka, right? Another one of these prisons where they put a lot of these Iraqis and stuff. That basically they were radicalized in U.S. prisons, that were like allowed to run these what they call jihadi universities, as the PBS headline says here, where basically then out of this you get this interesting situation where ISIS becomes advantageous for help to topple Assad eventually, which is another Israeli aspiration, right? Many headlines of that talking about how Netanyahu was proud of the fact that they like spearheaded this latest overthrow of Assad, and he's in what, Russia now or something like that, right? So this is not at all this is mainstream news, but I'm saying to put those pieces together of that puzzle of how they meddle and what group they support at certain times when it's advantageous, that story is very, very rich and expansive, you know.
Yeah. So this case put me on edge, and I was thinking about plan B. What happens if I always have to back up plans of all the things I'm involved in, that they don't go completely bust if something happens to me. But then actually came just a week later, a second case where a German was arrested. And so far I thought, well, they are trying to invoke now the Enemies Act from 1789.
Yep.
They have actually started doing that for the deportation of gang members here from Venezuela, and they're probably going to extend that to others. Of course, that's an act that was meant to be enforced during times of war, and we are not officially in a war with anyone. Even though you could say the United States in one way or another is always involved in some shadow war, some proxy war, or whatsoever.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So
Didn't they just drop bombs on Yemen?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, pretty much. It was almost the proxy war declaration of war against. Yeah, that one too. I'm sure a lot of things that we have forgotten in the Third World. It's going on. It keeps going on.
Sudan or some, you know, Somalia or something, you know, some shit like
that. Right. So you can always say, justify what we are at war with these or that, and then you just declare a new type of war against drugs, war against the cartels, war against whatever.
Yeah. War on drugs. That's right.
No, I was thinking that, well, Germany is not an enemy nation, even though strictly speaking, if you look at the United Nations Charter, it has still the paragraphs in there that says that Germany is an enemy nation, and they have not revoked that to this day.
That is correct.
But, of course, that's even the Germans don't want it revoked, because for it to be removed requires a peace treaty. A peace treaty opens so many cans of worms that nobody really thinks about a peace treaty with Germany. So, theoretically, we have an armistice between the United States and Germany since May 8th, 1945, but nothing more, legally speaking.
Legally speaking, they're an occupied country.
Yes, and the state of war has never been officially ended. Anyway, there's no one to make peace with from the old regime, and you have a new regime that was built up. So, but considering that Germany is not an enemy nation, I thought, well, if they invoke the Alien Act, it's not going to affect me. And right the day after this was brought up, that Trump is going to invoke it, I heard the news that a German immigrant green card holder coming back from a trip he had made back to his native Germany got arrested on the airport with a claim that his immigration file was flagged. And they then claimed that he had a hearing in 2022 where he was supposed to show up, and that was about an old controlled substance case. He evidently in California in 2015 was caught with some marijuana, and back then that was evidently more than private possession is allowed. So it was some 30 grams or so that's allowed for private possession. If more, you're considered a dealer. Back then it wasn't even legal in California, but it became legal shortly after. The case was eventually dismissed because it had become kind of legal. But still, the case was on the record. And with my situation, precarious as it can be, being involved in such controversial topic that they authorities don't like. I have smartened up on immigration law and how I have to behave and what risks are around where. And I know that if you are ever convicted of a controlled substance case, it is immediate reason for deportation. So there's zero tolerance when it comes to drug smuggling and selling. Now, he was evidently involved in such a case, but it was dismissed. But it was still enough for the immigration authorities to want to have an interview with him. So they scheduled an interview for 2022, right around the time or shortly after, the fellow had moved away from California to New York, I think, so to the other end of the country. Don't quote me exactly on where he moved into, but anyway, somewhere east. And so the notice to appear to the hearing didn't reach him. Then he was, and this is an automatic, if you, the immigration services schedule a hearing to which you have to appear and you don't show up, it's an immediate reason for deportation.
Right, yep.
If the reason why you don't show up is because you moved and you didn't notify the authorities timely enough of your new address, not informing the immigration services of a new address within 10 days is another reason for deportation.
Mm-hmm.
So you have over three: potential drug trading, not updating your record where you live. You know, there is no, for U.S. citizens, they don't have to register with the authorities where they live. Citizens can live wherever they want and they don't have to tell anyone. But as an immigrant, you always have to tell the authorities where you are, so that they can reach you and that they can grab you and throw you out if they want to, basically. So he failed on that, and then he didn't show up for the hearing because he hadn't informed where he was. A lot of things that with under any administration would automatically have led to his file being flagged, and I was told from a number of lawyers, this and this happens, your file gets flagged, and if you ever show up at the immigration services or go through immigration when you pass the border, coming in or out of the country, not out of the country, it doesn't control, but coming back into the country, you will get arrested. So that would happen to him. After reading this, I realized it has nothing to do with Trump's campaign.
Right.
It's just an automatic thing that happens if you have all these problems with your behavior. So I relaxed after that again. And then I heard we have this website up here that by now the Germans have three cases where people were arrested, and so this is a sudden
spike. Get those Germans out, you know, that's the big problem right now.
is there a connection with Trump's new policy, or are they all? My impression is right now everybody, particularly in our circles, is so alert and paranoid about what the authorities do that we pay attention to every case that happens and get crazy about it.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what happened during the Biden administration, if you look at the numbers, during the Biden administration, per day, many more immigrants got arrested and deported than what is happening currently in the Trump administration.
Yep.
Of course, they had much more material to deport because there were so many more illegal border crossings during the Biden administration than there are now under Trump, primarily because the Trump scare has evidently had an effect on a lot of immigrants not wanting to risk to come here because they're not sure what kind of treatment they're going to get. Be that as it may, I have relaxed a little bit looking at this, but I can't say I'm completely at ease because it's not for the lack of trying that the administration wants to do stuff. The judiciary still puts pretty much a stop to it for now, but I'll keep my ear on those cases and my eyes on those cases to see how they will be resolved.
Yeah, I wonder what steps then they will do next, because obviously as we showed a couple of those headlines there, there's been some judges, they step in and they try to block this. Now, the Alien Enemies Act is a different thing, and obviously I think it's good that they're deporting those Venezuelans. I think it was El Salvadorians, right? It was Bukele. He received them. He has some whole prison system scheme going and stuff, and he was happy to, you know, help the U.S. in that regard, right?
Because he gets money.
Yeah, and he generates money too. The prison, like, basically has set up a whole new structure of how to deal with these gang, you know, criminals, right, and stuff like that, right? So that's obviously, you know, a good thing. But as we said, though, that, you know, it's about what kind of tone you set for this, and then how easily legally it will be to just anybody, because, you know, that's why I put it in the title, right? It's, they would say, oh, he's a pro-Hamas supporter. Okay, well, let's argue what the proof of that is and whatnot, right? But is it enough to just be critical of Israel? Not loving Israel enough, right? We don't. And there's kind of been statements like this, essentially, from some people out there, from a, maybe not Tom Homan hasn't said this, but obviously Marco Rubio has talked in these tones. Who else was it that did it recently? I forget. It was one person in the administration, a couple. There was like, and Trump himself said it on Truth Social, a couple of posts, right? That like they're anti-Semites, maybe, right? Essentially, and that they don't belong in America. And so, can you criticize Israel? Is that okay? Right. You know, kind of thing, right?
Maybe we should play the clip where Rubio is asked about this case and then makes a statement.
Yeah, let's listen to that.
To come.
Okay, here we go.
Envoy Witkoff, I want to ask you about a decision you made to revoke a student visa for someone at Columbia University this past week. The Wall Street Journal editorial board writes, the administration needs to be careful. It's targeting real promoters of terrorism, not breaking the great promise of a green card by deporting anyone with controversial political views. Can you substantiate any form of material support for terrorism, specifically to Hamas, from this Columbia student, or was it simply that he was espousing a controversial political point of view?
Well, not just the student. We're going to do more. In fact, we every day now we're approving visa revocations, and if that visa led to a green card, the green card process as well. And here's why. It's very simple. When you apply to enter the United States and you get a visa, you are a guest. And you're coming as a student, you're coming as a tourist or what have you. And in it, you have to make certain assertions. And if you tell us when you apply for a visa, I'm coming to the U.S. to participate in pro-Hamas events, that runs counter to the foreign policy interest of the United States of America. It's that simple. So you lied. You came. If you had told us that you were going to do that, we never would have given you the visa. Now you're here. Now you do it. So you lied to us. You're out. It's that simple.
But
it's
is
that
there
straightforward.
But is there any evidence of a link to terrorism, or is it just his point of view?
Yeah, they take over. I mean, you should watch the news. These guys take over entire buildings. They vandalize colleges.
Intensely.
They shut down
I'm
colleges.
I'm asking about the specific justification for the revocation of his visa. Was there any evidence of material support for terrorism?
The spokesperson was the negotiator. Negotiating on behalf of people that took over a campus, that vandalized buildings? Negotiating over what? That's a crime in and of itself, that they're involved in being the negotiator, the spokesperson, this, that, the other. We don't want it. We don't need these people in our country. We never should have allowed them in the first place. If he had told us, I'm going over there and I'm going over there to become the spokesperson and one of the leaders of a movement that's going to turn one of your allegedly elite colleges upside down, people can't even go to school, library buildings being vandalized, we never would have let him in. We never would have let him in to begin with. And now that he's doing it and he's here, he's going to leave, and so are others, and we're going to keep doing it. And by the way, I find it ironic that a lot of these people out there defending the First Amendment alleged free speech rights of these Hamas sympathizers, they had no problem, pressuring social media to censor American political speech. So I think it's ironic and hypocritical. But the bottom line is this. If you are in this country to promote Hamas, to promote terrorist organizations, to participate in vandalism, to participate in acts of rebellion and riots on campus, we never would have let you in if we had known that. And now that we know it,
you're
going to leave.
Is it only pro-Palestinian people who are going to have their visas revoked, or are other points of view as well?
No, I think anybody who's here in favor, look, we want to get rid of Tren de Aragua gang members. They're terrorists, too. The president designated them, asked me to designate, and I did, as a terrorist organization. We want to get rid of them as well. We don't want terrorists in America. I don't know how hard that is to understand. We don't want people in our country that are going to be committing crimes and undermining our national security or the public safety. It's that simple. Especially people that are here as guests. That is what a visa is. I don't know where we've gotten it in our head that a visa is some sort of birthright. It is not. It is a visitor into our country. And if you violate the terms of your visitation, you are going to leave.
Okay. Secretary Rubio.
So like obviously what irks me about this is also look at the Columbia University environment, right, of like decades of just anti-white, anti-colonialist, anti-European talking points. And again, let's be honest, Columbia University, this is where the Frankfurt School set up their base after they were, pushed out of Germany at the time, right? They created this environment of sorts. They've gone after you know, yeah, this is at the colonialist talking points, just white people bad. Right? That's the meme, but that's what they've been doing. And it's not until the issue of Israel comes up, right? Now this is a crisis. It's a foreign policy issue from the point of view of the, you know, America and the Trump administration and the, you know, because their interest is more important apparently than Americans. They have openly discriminated against white students. They have lessened to bring in white students, etc. You see where I'm going with this. But now this is one bridge too far for them. What do you make of this?
Rubio dodged every single question that he was asked. Is there any concrete evidence that he was materially supporting a terrorist organization, specifically Hamas? There was no answer to it. He said, well, there was vandalism, and he was negotiating. The question is, was he involved in vandalism? Had he been, he would have been criminally charged, because vandalism is a crime, right? There is no criminal charge, not even a claim that there is any crime committed. So, yeah, there may have been vandalism. I don't know what has been going on in detail there. But he evidently is not the person who has called for it. And he is not the person who had been involved in it. He has been involved in negotiations, but not about whether to stop or not stop the vandalism. So Rubio is changing the topic, is changing the narrative there to something completely else. And then he comes up with it. Terrorists from Nicaragua or from wherever they are, some from Venezuela. That's not Mahmoud Khalil's category. It's something completely different. So you see they're trying to use rhetoric that may apply to some people on a completely different category of people. And this is just not right. I'm thinking that most of the vandalizers probably were U.S. citizen students, and they can't go after them except for maybe giving us a ticket or a misdemeanor charge, but it's not gone anywhere. So
you do have a lot of interesting things as well. Let me show you this. Remember this? Here's the Swedish Nordic Resistance Movement was labeled or designated a terrorist organization. Three of its leaders were sanctioned or whatnot, right? And they've never been involved in any kind of terrorism or anything like that. This is what's so ridiculous, right? And now, if you read the language within this, now, again, that's why how I see this could kind of expand as well. That, like, I mean, look, I could, you know, he's here on a student visa. First, it was this question, Khalil, that we talked about, right? He was here on a student visa. And then there was an issue, did he overstay that? Or was he, you know, still active student in the school or whatnot, right?
He came into the country with a student visa, and after a certain period of time, he got married to a U.S. citizen, and based on that, he was able to receive a permanent legal residency.
Right.
So he's married to a U.S. citizen, and she's pregnant with his child, and so he is now not, and this is another thing, that he completely goes off track. He is not here on a visa anymore. A visa can be revoked, yes. It's relatively easy, and a visa runs out. Any visa is temporary, and eventually it will be over with. No, he's here as a permanent legal resident. In order to revoke that, it's not that easy, because I don't like his behavior views. He needs to have certain criminal charges and having been convicted for them. Unless that is the case, you simply can't revoke that. So we will see how that goes. I don't think that any judge will go along with this, revoking a green card because you don't like someone's nose, because that's what it amounts to, unless they can file criminal charges against them and succeed in court with it. This is not going anywhere. And if it were, then the whole system of permanent legal residency in the United States would collapse. Anyone could just be thrown out at any point if that happens.
Yeah.
I see, as in one case already, a certain person deported herself, as they say, official language is that it's a voluntary departure.
Yeah, I mean, they could change the legal framework, right? They can, whatever reason. I mean, it's their country that can decide that, which is fine. I mean, it's like, these are the criteria. Okay, and now they're changed. Okay, well, you know, it's kind of tough luck. Because what I'm saying is, what does this, you know, there's so many problems. So this is just like taking one little, you know, pee out of a bowl of peas and saying, here, this is the problem right here. But regardless, let's just look at it for what it is, right? Is that the pro-Palestinian thing at these universities? I understand that it's free speech and all these things, but does it belong in America? Like, I get the argument, right? Like, if you're so fanatical about Palestine, you could go there and fight for Palestine. You know, I get that. I know you're also arguing just the legal aspect of this, like what is actually legal or whatnot. But at the same time, I'm also pro, obviously, America having the immigration policy that they do want. As I said before, what irks me is that it only seems that it's over the Israeli thing now, that they're just, the whole machine springs into action when you've had, other interest groups and other ethnic groups that are like undermining American interests and the European heritage of America and things like this. You see what I'm saying? Like, I think it's fine for them to take charge of how they want to direct their country and who belongs and not. But it's like, this is what it's doing. And of course, that reflects the disproportionate power that the Jewish lobby, the Israeli lobby has in the U.S. And it was not until these campus protests popped up, tons of people like, what's happening? Like, this is no good. We got to shut this down. Same thing in many European countries. Remember those huge protests? Yeah. All the Muslim populations in Europe that they've brought in are now all of a sudden, protesting over the Israel-Palestine stuff. And it was like the establishment, even Henry Kissinger, remember this? This is a headline for you here. Henry Kissinger on Hamas attacks fallout. Germany let in too many foreigners. Mass immigration was a grave mistake. And now they're acting like this is like, whoopsie, we made a mistake, kind of thing. It's like, well, you made this situation. You created this.
Deborah Lipset, in the book you just showed 10, 15 minutes ago, has a line in there that says, if we let Germany have control over their own history, if we let German historians decide what German history looks like, if we lose control over what is allowed and not allowed to be said in Germany, we understood as the Jews, then things are going to really go bad. We need to make sure that the Germans understand that when it comes to immigration, they have to accept whoever and whenever someone comes to their country and wants to be accepted. There is, with Germany's past, no alternative but to accept anyone who flees persecution or destitution or whatever it is. So she was pushing that envelope with German guilt for the Holocaust, require them eternally to accept whatever economic or political refugee knocks at their door. And that's exactly the policy that Jews in particular, but the whole left-wing scene in Germany and the liberals and everyone else has been pursuing ever since the 1960s.
Yeah.
And the result you can see now, and suddenly they don't like it anymore. You know, I've said for years, the Jews should think that they cannot milk the cow they slaughter. And they're slaughtering. They're slaughtering every country in Europe.
Yeah.
By destroying family values with their ideologies, important ideologies. You meant the Frankfurt School. That was one of their main aims, is destroying family values in Germany.
Yep.
And then this demographic collapse started, which inevitably has to lead to mass immigration, because otherwise the whole society would collapse. You have no alternative but to have mass immigration. If you stop having babies, somebody else is going to have them. And that's just the way it is. And now the kind of people that come in, they don't like.
Is that true, though? I mean, look at how Germany recovered after the war. Massive amounts of Germans died, and still they recovered, and that was without immigration. When did the Turks come in? Was that 60s, 70s to build, to help?
60s, 70s.
Yeah, so I mean, that's almost a decade and a half later.
The year of the most live birth in German history was 1964. That's the year I was born.
Right,
and my generation calls itself the year of the many. In 1965, the anti-baby pill was introduced in Germany. And that was the end of the story. Anti-baby pill is leading the German people, and not only them, to extinction. Okay? This is a choice. It's not like anyone is getting forced to take the anti-baby pill. That's a choice that everyone has. But with materialism, hedonism, and the destruction of family values, of love as the central core value of any nation, substituted with self-realization and liberalization and all the stuff that
look at that. The pill was a catalyst for the sexual revolution, right? And so it's free
fornication,
free love,
with impunity.
Exactly. So, yeah. Yes, that has definitely helped with the collapse of the birth rates in Europe and America, obviously. Did they go to Africa and introduce the pill there? I don't think they did they?
Oh, yes. It's not quite catching on yet, but
that didn't help.
India has announced this year, just a couple of months ago, I think, that their birth rate has now dropped beneath the sustainable rate.
And they're proud of it. It's interesting.
It took them 25 years to get there. And I said, in 25 years, or in 50, or whatever it was, compared to England, their big motherland, who took 150 years to get from extreme population growth, which they had throughout the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, to the point where they controlled their birth rates, and they're comparing apples with eggs because they have the pill now and they have a completely different environment. And through the 19th century, there was no birth control worth mentioning. So you get married, you have children, that's just the way it is. You have a sexual drive and it will inevitably lead to pregnancy. That's not the case anymore. The detachment of reproductive success from sexual activity is the one thing that is unique for mankind. The only species on this planet has ever managed to couple the two things and is headed for extinction because of it.
Yeah.
If we don't watch our asses.
Yeah, modernity is our enemy. Comfort is our enemy. But it's there now. It is what it is, right? But yeah, if you look statistically, a lot of developing countries, and of course, a lot of them are attaining, you know, fairly, not across the board, but, you know, generally here and there, more modern type Western lifestyles, if you want to look at that. And many of those countries, many of those populations are actually declining faster than many European countries are, or were at least, and some of our countries have kind of of stabilized a little bit, but they're declining faster than ours. Yeah,
they have to battle two things. They have to battle declining birth rates and mass emigration.
Exactly. Yep. Yep.
In Germany,
but
you have
some of them definitely have the
population
to cope with that, though. I mean, there's India, China, obviously.
For them it takes a while, but it's coming. It's just a matter of time.
Yep.
When you look at Germany and England in particular, they are such attractive immigration countries where everybody wants to go. The German is because of their
welfare
system that throws just money at everyone. And the English, because the English language, almost everyone speaks there already, so it's an easy start. And of course, they had the empire everywhere, and they have relationships and special deals with this and that country. And that makes it kind of easy.
Yeah, commonwealth, legal structure, yeah.
Right. Common chaos. Anyway, so they can substitute or replenish their population with immigration because they are so attractive. It's different if you look at Greece, Italy, Spain. They're not that attractive. And they are having a really hard time with this situation if it weren't for Europeans shuffling immigrants around. And Eastern countries, even worse, where they don't fare well economically if they're not part of the European Union. And right now, locked in a war, Russia and Ukraine, they have demographic collapse, no immigration, they have massive emigration, and they have a war going on.
Yeah.
These two countries will collapse so fast within a couple of generations, it will be lights out for both of them.
Well, they're already calling for, into Ukraine, making up for the loss of the whole generation of men that are being killed in the meat grinder with the immigration from the third world. The headlines are popping out now. We call it from the beginning, too. That's what they're going to do. And, of course, you know, here we are. They're going to call
it.
I'll say this. At the same time, countries that do not take in immigration long-term will fare much better than countries that do. You have to take into the fact, first of all, they say, oh, well, you know, someone's got to do the jobs or whatever. Then you discover a lot of them are social, you know, they're on welfare. They become dependents on the country as opposed to a contributor to it. The second issue, of course, is now you have internal destabilization. You have Balkanization. Now we have different ethnic groups competing over power internally. The long-term effects of that, I think, is obviously far, far worse than a country that's like, all right, well, let's see what happens, shall we? Economically, we might not do good, but it's not all about the GDP. This is about, you know, our ethnic survival, you know?
If the demographic collapse can at some point be turned around.
I think it's inevitable that it will, because you do have there's upsides with it, right? I mean, look at house prices, availability, these kinds of things. Like many of our countries now, look at Canada. It's like a prime example, right? But it's happening all over the West, essentially. There's no houses. They're continuing to flood their country with immigrants. Young Canadians, they can't, even if they could find a house, they couldn't afford it. In other words, they can't, you know, fly out of the nest from their parents' house. They can't, you know, start a life on their own. They're certainly not going to have kids in that type of environment. It's undermining. I think that's a plan, obviously, but I'm saying that's undermining the capability of the native populations in most European countries to actually get off their, you know, asses and start, you know, having kids and having families like everyone else did when they were around that age, like prior generations did. But now it's like close to impossible to do that, you know?
At the end, those population groups with attitudes of family value, of loving children and having children, will be the ones that survive.
Absolutely.
And will be the ones that will thrive and take over. I've made that comment a number of times. If you look here in America, the African-American group is slowly but surely sliding into demographic collapse as well. Mexicans or Hispanics of the second and third generation don't reproduce sufficiently either. It's being upheld by continuous immigration. White population is going downward. But if you look at the one population group in the United States that is having an exponential growth, an explosive growth, you can say, and it's a white population.
The Amish.
The Amish, right. They double every 15 years, a little over a million right now, I think.
And they also don't have modernity. Isn't that fascinating, the correlation there?
Right. So these kinds of people with that kind of attitude will be the ones taken over. It's inevitable. Fundamentalism, but that's
well, yeah, that's just nature. There's no referee here that's going to step in and blow the whistle and say, that's unfair. This is just what it is. We're still part of nature, despite all the modernity and all our, you know, gadgets and what have you. We're still, beholden to the rules of nature, and that's just how it is. But you know, again, I get all those points and whatnot. I'm just not as pessimistic because I see that like a rebound, and you also have to take into account of like in the past you had tremendously many more people that died for different reasons. They were taken out. They were not even maybe well, they were kind of odd or weird or whatever, like, you know, the spiteful mutants is a term that's caught on in these circles in regards to that like these might have been people that were ostracized in the past. Now in the modern age, everyone survives essentially, right? You can basically plan your family. You intend to have two kids or one or three, and generally most of those will survive. In the past, that was not the case. If you wanted, you know, if you had like, we got to have five kids, you had to have like 10 because five of them probably will not survive. But you know, refrigeration, antibiotics, medicine, other things, right, has led to everyone survives. But that also preserves every single mutation, genetically speaking. And so these times are unprecedented in the sense that our population are just ballooning and exploding, or have been at least. And now you're finally kind of beginning to see a contraction again. And I think that's normal. I actually think that's nature coming back into the picture.
To some degree, to some degree it's necessary. The planet cannot sustain 9 billion people at a living standard as all everyone wants to have it. Like,
It's impossible.
So the planet wouldn't be able to sustain that. So we need to get down to a lower level. How we get there is the trick, and how then when we get down, how we stabilize the situation. But it's in the far future, and we don't have to solve problems.
No, it's not our worry right now. But yeah, it's far too many people right now. That's what I think in a way. Okay, so let me see here. So we've talked about Rubio and stuff. What else can we tie into this picture here? Because I think, you know, again, my point of bringing up the Nordic Resistance Movement was also done. Now, this was done under Biden, and these good things in reverse or whatever. Where did the story go here? But it is interesting that, a group or an organization out of Sweden that hasn't been involved in any type of terrorism can be designated as a terrorist group. Who are the interests behind that, etc. But if you look at some of the readings of this and go through it, it's like if you give them educational, like, you know, like if you talk to them, is that a, you know, anyone who's a member, then you're, you know, it's very interesting. This could happen technically to any group, but there could be political parties in Europe that rises up, and then America decides, we don't like that party. We're going to terrorist label them. It's very frivolous, I guess. But it's always been. That's my point, too. It's just that we're in a very different political environment now. With the last couple of decades, things have been so kind of blown out of proportion, so much focus and attention on political issues like it wasn't in the past. I think this is a natural outcome of like social media. People generally seem to be more aware. You have more pushback against establishment political views. I mean, the prior, you know, administration, they had their issues, whether it was the COVID restrictions and people were sharing information about that. And it was almost like, it's not that they terrorist labeled them, obviously, but there's like misinformation is one of the biggest threats that there is. Disinformation, we have to censor, we have to block, we have to do all these things. It's a very different environment now. And I think this is a sign of that, too. We're essentially a group that's like looking out for its own, you know, ethnic preservation, essentially, is now labeled a terrorist movement.
I took the time to read what you have up there. And they are accused of having been involved in violent attacks on immigrants, pro-Jewish or Jewish and LGBTQ platforms and so forth. I don't know whether that's true, but if it does...
Most of that is defensive during their protests or marches and things like that, where they've actually been attacked and then they defend themselves, which right. I guess they're not allowed to do. Right. But as far as I know, maybe there's cases I'm not aware of, but that's as far as I understand the situation, that's basically what that is.
Yeah, that reminds me of things that have happened here too during the marches. In, where was that done? In South Carolina, North Carolina, somewhere where this happened. There was a right-wing...
Oh, you're talking about Charlottesville?
Protest. Charlottesville, yeah.
Yeah, oh, cool. Yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly. Well, same thing there. There was literally, I was there. I mean, that was literally like the cops were like, you got to leave, right? The order to, what do you call it? Dissolve the, I mean, it wasn't a protest. It was actually speeches that were going to be held in Lee Park in front of the statue that was about to be taken down. And then, of course, it ramps up. It's under Trump's first administration, becomes this whole political thing. And oh, my God, you know. And eventually, of course, the police says, oh, no, your right to protest or have this gathering has been revoked. You got to leave. And the police basically pushed all of the protesters into the arms of the counter protesters. So they initiated the violence, essentially. But anyway, that's a different story.
Yeah. Anyway, Koto's founder and longtime head, Bradley Smith, has been listed as among the 10 top extremists in America until his death in 2000. And what was that? Well, until he kind of ran out at mid-2010. You see an angle here, an organization that does free speech lobbying on a topic that powerful groups don't want to hear dissenting views on, or don't want to have them voiced publicly, to be pushed in an extremist corner. The only extreme thing that Bradley Smith has ever lobbied for is free speech and open debate on that topic. So
right.
Free speech and open debate is an extreme idea when it comes to this topic. And that does show you not so much the extremist views that members of CODO have, but the extreme situation that a society finds itself in, where opinion leaders and powerful political group can push the narrative successfully that people insisting on civil rights are extremists. And that's a very dangerous situation we find ourselves in as a society, when just normal free speech lobbying becomes an extremist activity. And it's only a little step then to say it's a terrorist organization, because if you're getting pushed in the corner, turned into pariah, being deprived of rights, and some of your supporters are being even persecuted, being denied equal economic opportunity by being denied banking rights and so forth, all these things are happening. At some point, someone will snap. It has nothing to do with what the organization promotes, supports, condones, justifies in any way. But we had one supporter of ours, and was not a part of the organization, but he was a supporter, a small-time donor on occasion, went on a rampage at the Washington, D.C. Holocaust Memorial Museum.
When was this?
In 2009, I was just about to be released from a German prison when I learned it by reading it in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. I read the name of the person, and I had him on the list of people who had written me into prison. And he had contributed to my prison defense fund. There is a memorial plaque inside the museum. If you go into the Holocaust Memorial Museum ever, in the entry lobby, there
I have no intention pillars. To talk
about it. Okay. There's one of the pillars had a memorial plaque that memorialized the one guard, an African-American guard, who was shot by this person. I never met that person personally. But I, needless to say, I was shocked, because nothing what we do or say, what we promote or lobby for, has justifies in any way violence. Quite to the contrary, we have a strict rule that nothing is acceptable that amounts to denying other people's their civil rights, other people their civil rights and right to self-determination, because if we do that step, we can't insist on our own civil rights. If you use your civil right of speech, free speech, to deny other people in any way their civil rights, you lose the moral justification of using and having your own civil rights. Therefore, it's a no-go. And of course, killing people, hurting people, doing any kind of violence against people is a massive violation of the victim's civil right. And therefore, it's a big no-go zone for us as an organization. Yet still, it happened. And why did it happen? The guy was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he was thinking how to best spend the last day of his life by doing something that, if I, you know, it's a Samson option. If I'm going down, somebody will go down with me.
Samson option. Yeah.
The idea of going into a Holocaust Memorial Museum and shooting people up. You don't shoot Jews there if you go in there. You choose shoot guards, people at the register, and tourists and museum visitors. The probability that you get a Jew is, even if it would have been even worse, if, I mean, it's so far beyond what I can wrap myself around. With all the persecution, oppression that I've personally experienced, never been pushed anywhere close to the point where I thought I would become violent. But there is, it happened. And that gives, of course, the system, if they could make a connection between the two. Now, he, as I mentioned, he was never associated in any way other than having given a few donations on occasion with our organization.
But that's enough for the system to say, see, there's a link, he bad, right. You bad. You know, yeah, of course, right, that's how it works. Yeah.
Now, that's so far, as I know, the only case, and I don't want more. And that's why I've put up over and over again, and I'm talking about this once in a while. I have, when I launched the encyclopedia, I had a preface in there. I had to retract it because I got so much pushback from within the quote-unquote community that was hinting at the fact that I do not want this to be misunderstood as a tool to be used to justify limiting Jewish or Zionist civil rights. That's a no-go zone. It was seen as inappropriate. It doesn't belong in an encyclopedia. So I've retracted it. It's actually still online, not directly linked, but it's sitting there. I want to always get the message out with all the controversy, with all the dissent, with all the skepticism that we espouse, that we get into confrontation with the mainstream. There's not a single justification in any of this to to take measures that violate anyone's civil rights.
Is it totally irrelevant to your work? Your work is academic and scientific and historical and understanding it and, you know, truth. that's what it is. It's not, you know, it's not political activism per se. I mean, you can... An extension on that could be, or that someone uses material from that, and you know, justify this or that. But ultimately, you, as far as your work is right. concerned, this is to coming to the bottom of a question which has been, you know, discouraged, and in some cases, violently discouraged from being discussed publicly. Historical events, you know, World War II, what happened? What happened with the gas chambers? All that stuff.
There has been a lot of violence against revisionists.
Exactly.
Much yes. more.
Yeah.
Arsons, firebombing, letter bombs, physical attacks, assassinations. So the equation, the balance when you look at it is I can't say, you know, a favor, morally speaking, when it comes to violence. It's a bad comparison to make. But anyway, the situation has gotten a little better. The last book that I released, it's a Nazi gas chambers, the roots of the story. I managed to connect some dots when I was, I mentioned that before, when I was writing the encyclopedia, showing actually how that story was created during the war, primarily by a Polish underground, and after the war, during and after the war by Soviets. And then the Stalinist Polish judiciary at the end of the war, pushing the narrative in the German-Polish conflict, which was the core of the Second World War. That's where it broke out because of territorial claims made by both sides against each other after the First World War. That spiraled straight into the Second World War. And after the Second World War, the Poles wouldn't make sure that they ram some stakes into the ground and say, this is now all ours, and you will never ask us for any justice. We take so much territory from you now and expel every one of you, and then ram down this genocidal story down your throat so that you will feel eternally guilty and accept any kind of punishment that will be imposed on you after that war. That's pretty much a success. It has nothing to do with Jews. Now, even that story doesn't today justify any action against the Poles who live today. That's all history. It's just important to understand where the story comes from. It's not a Jewish conspiracy. And I've laid it out in that booklet very nicely. It's mainly the Stalinist Polish judicial authorities, probably instructed by higher-ups and their political leadership in Poland, maybe from Moscow, to solidify and streamline this narrative that had evolved out of war propaganda from various sites. I just had a discussion. I don't know whether you had seen my debate with a mainstream professor Dr. Fan on the Jake Shields show.
Not the whole thing. I saw clips, but I didn't see the whole the entire piece. Yeah. Yep.
Now, this exchange was interesting for a number of reasons, but it was also a little bit unfortunate because Jake Shields kept interrupting when I was trying to make a point. Dr. Van was asking a lot of questions, and he wanted to get my point of view because he knew the mainstream point of view. Everybody knows the mainstream narrative on the Holocaust.
But he wasn't that well-versed in the topic as far as
he wasn't that well-versed, but he was genuinely curious to find out what my views are and what sets it apart from the cliche that's out there about Holocaust denial.
Yeah.
So it was very fair. But then I'm getting asked a simple question, which, however, comes with a complex answer because things aren't always simple. And Jake Shields kept interrupting me. He wasn't good. But anyway, at one point he says, Jake Shields says, one of the most important and convincing arguments that are brought forward by the mainstream is that the Holocaust was thoroughly demonstrated and proven, the mainstream narrative, during the Nuremberg trials after the war. And Dr. Van says, yeah, there was plenty of evidence presented there that is, for him, convincing. And I wasn't really
like confessions able to and stuff like that, right? Confessions and
confessions, documents, government reports, yeah. All kinds of things that were presented. And I started to briefly get into it and give him one example that was presented during the Nuremberg trials, the Majdanek camp. The Russians introduced an expert report saying 1.5 million people died there in 7 gas chambers. And today's narrative says simply it's 78,000 people, not 1.5 million, 78,000 who died there. And there were only 2 gas chambers, not 7. So it's a drastic and massive downward revision that is getting much, much closer to the revisionist position. But then I got cut short. We got derailed by another question by Jake Shields, and it kind of trailed off. But I thought it's an important topic to address, because indeed for a lot of people the Nuremberg trials, 42 volumes documentation for the International Military Tribunal and another 15 volumes I think for the Nuremberg Military Tribunals that were done afterwards by the Americans only, that's a massive amount of documentation and needs addressing. How do we revisionists counter that? And I thought, okay, I'm going to write a book. You can't do that in a 1 hour, 2 hour podcast that can only go so deep into so few topics for so little time that needs thorough coverage. And I sat down, I just now wrapped it up yesterday, the manuscript.
Did you go through the entire, all the court documents and the records and all that?
This is only the International Military Tribunal.
Okay.
I've limited that to the biggest, where the most evidence on a broad variety of topics was presented by all four powers. And in the background by the Poles, who were feeding their stuff through their proxies, the Soviets. The Nuremberg Military Tribunals under the Americans is a separate issue. If I were to cover everything, the book would just balloon a little bit out of proportion. So I limited by scope to that. But there are other studies that have addressed already the issues that were dealt with in the Nuremberg trials, and I'm referencing them. So if you want to have something on that, it can be found elsewhere. So this is currently being peer-reviewed. Should be out within a month, hopefully.
Okay.
Nice. We have a good book to point people to if they come up with that argument. But it has been proven during the IMT after the war. And here's then how you can read what that evidence presented there is worth.
Interesting. All right.
The conclusion, I say, well, it's not worth, most of it, it's not worth the paper it's written on. And the proof lies in the pudding, which I present here with further readings giving plenty.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say we've all heard, but I'm saying one of the more, common understandings people are, they're at least remotely interested in these kinds of things, is, of course, how testimony or confessions were made under torture and, things like this, essentially.
Right.
Where you can't try, this, and this is common. This is not, unique to this period only. These are, as we said before, the victors are the liberators and they're the great heroes and whatnot. And those who lose, they're the villains. That's how it pans out. But of course, that doesn't mean that that's true, obviously. Right. So.
Yeah. Forged document, misinterpreted documents, a documentary that has true imagery with false captions and a false narrative. All these things have been introduced, and then you have government expert reports created by Soviet investigative commissions that make a mockery out of forensic science.
Yeah.
So there's a lot been going on during that trial that requires exposure to understand the travesty of justice that this mock trial was.
Yeah, oh, for sure, definitely. Is Germar Rudolph the best place to go for people to pick up copies of this when it's out, or any of your current ones?
That would be the bookstore. If you go to armreg.co.uk, that is where you could find it. Also, if you go to the Holocaust Encyclopedia, .com. It has a bookstore link there, and you can jump from there to the bookstore where you can find all the books. So let me...
I'll pull that up here too real quick. Anything else you want to mention about the current case? I mean, again, we'll keep an eye on that, obviously, and see what comes out of it, because this could extend, or, you know, there's judges trying to block it and stuff like that. You know, his no, not extradition, but his deportation. Let me see, I forgot an R in there. That's the problem, I think. Is this the page? Yes, that I think it is. I'll pull it up here in a moment. But anyway, anything else with the kid? What do you think is going to happen next here with Khalil, I got to pronounce it correctly, I guess.
Khalil, the KH is the kh sound, which doesn't exist in the English language. As a matter of fact, if you look at all the GHs in the English language, sorry for the digression, you look at the word night, it has a N-I-G-H-T. The GH doesn't get pronounced. You look at laughter, it just turns into an F. If you look at sight and light, it has all the G-H in there, and it doesn't make any sounds, or in some rare cases, it makes an F sound. So why is it in there? Now, if you know the equivalent German word, which is almost identical, but has not a G-H, but a C-H, and the C-H is pronounced Ch.
Or Knecht. Knecht, right?
Licht is light. Instead of L-I-G-H-T, you have L-I-C-H-T.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Night is Nacht. G-H-T turns into C-H-T. So the English language has lost the ability of pronouncing the C-H, but in the words as you spell them, it's still there. It's the G-H that used to be Juch.
Yeah, okay.
But it doesn't have that function anymore, and it's simply ignored when speaking it, you have now agreed on the K-H having that function, but nobody understands. You have to actually rasp. How do you hiss or
modern problems. Yeah, and here's the website. Armreg.
There's the Armreg. Yes, that's where, if you scroll down, you find the last release that I had with the Nazi gas chambers.
Yep, right there.
There it is.
Yep.
And as soon as the new one will be released in a month or so, it should be appearing on top.
Okay.
So armreg.co.uk.
Very good. All right. Any other closing thoughts about the topic at hand, or any other issue here before we wrap up for today?
If you want to get into, anyone want to get in touch with me, germarudolf.com is my own site. You had it up just briefly.
Yep.
Right and it has a contact page. You can see how you can get in touch there. And if you want to donate, support me in any way, it has a pay and donate page. You can find out how you can chip in. And there's always a link somewhere to the encyclopedia for people who are interested in that.
I saw some people were in chat, were talking about PDF versions. You have both, right? You have EPUB and PDF and a hard copy, right? Of most books. Is that correct?
Yes, on the sales website we just saw, books are offered in various formats. You can have them as hard copy, as PDF, or as EPUB, and some even as an audiobook. And when it comes to the Holocaust Handbook series, the hard-hitting research series, they come all with three PDFs and EPUBs. They can all be downloaded from the dedicated website, holocausthandbooks.com. So, yeah, you see there it comes in various formats.
Yeah, there you go. I'm right there, folks. Not every book, but many of them do come in different options there. Audio, paperback, and, of course, ebook, either as PDF or EPUB, if you prefer that, on your tablet reader and stuff like that. All right, very good.
I got MP3.
Yes, MP3 for the audio. Very, very good. We got two huge super chats here as well from Mycroft Wins. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate that greatly. Cheers, Henrik, he says first. And then says, never get rattled. That's correct. Never get rattled. Keep moving, slow and steady. That's what does it. Thank you so much, sir. I can't thank you enough for that. That's tremendous. You're helping to keep the lights on over here as well. Thank you so much, sir. Okay. Yeah, I think we'll wrap up right there then. Awesome to see you again, Germar. Thank you for coming on. And again, we'll refer people to the publisher website, armreg.co.uk, if you want to go straight there. And of course, you also have germarrudolf.com. All right, good stuff. Yes. Good having you back. Thank you.
Yep.
Appreciate your time.
Much appreciated.
Awesome. All right, we'll talk again. Keep up the good work. Obviously, we need people like you out there chipping away and slow and steady. How long have you been doing this for now? It was like three decades?
Since 1990, 1991, I got involved. So that's almost 35 years now. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you, Germán. We appreciate your work. And yeah, you're a real hero for being out there talking about these kinds of things and digging into this kind of stuff that most people don't. But at the end of the day, you know, they're like the stuff that we can pull out from the work that you do to understand the situation better and put it in context, too, of how we are in the situation that we are right now is vital. So thank you, Germán, for your work. We appreciate it greatly. Awesome.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. All right, guys. That's it for today, then. We're going to be back with more here soon. Obviously, we do have, I think Sam Parker is going to join us Thursday in studio. He's around these parts then, so tune in for that. We haven't set a time yet. I think around 2 p.m. Pacific, so 5 p.m. Eastern, something like that, which is 10 p.m. Central European time because the time difference is a little bit off until the Europeans set back their daylight savings time issue there. But tune in for that Thursday. We have more coming up, Flashback Friday, stuff like that, obviously. But thank you, guys. We'll see you guys later. Thank you again to Mycroft Wins. We appreciate you. We'll be back with more soon. Until then, take care. Folk first.
New Red Ice merch available now. Folk first t-shirts for adults and for toddlers. Fatigues for men. Our favorite, the Red Ice camper mug or ceramic with black print. High quality leather keychain with solar boat imprint. Our Red Ice hat, one of our best sellers. Pick one up today. Or why not gray Auslander Rouse t-shirts for both women and men. We also have fridge magnets, Folk First, One Disease, and our black men's t-shirt with the classic red solar boat. Folk First. Get your Red Ice merch from LanasLlama.com. Get an item today. Lana's Llama, proud sponsor of Red Ice.
Thank you for watching. Go to redicemembers.com and sign up for exclusive members content. Don't miss our latest shows, interviews, and other videos only for subscribers. You can also become a member by signing up at subscribestar.com/redice. Get full access and help support our work. See you on the other side.